from Montpelier, Vermont. This is Public Health Radio. On today's show, our guests are Michael Wilkes and Gavin Yamey. They'll be discussing cancer screening and the controversy that occurred when they publicly recommended that we discontinue screening for prostate cancer. Then, in our viewpoint segment, I'll be revisiting the relationship between energy policy and public health and evaluate the president's energy program, which will soon be coming up for votes in both houses of Congress. But first, some news from the world of public health. Our first news item explores how vested interests may impact the translation of research data into medical practice. Due to the massive volume of research published both in the U.S. and abroad, it turns out to be impossible for doctors to gain perspective on what the state of the art is for each clinical problem they face. So for several hundred important clinical problems, such as the treatment of diabetes or heart failure or ear infection, expert panels are convened to undertake a thoughtful review of available research and give treatment recommendations. These recommendations are called clinical practice guidelines. They are widely distributed, and their intent is to change physicians' medical decisions. So any influence of a drug company on an individual author is multiplied thousands of times over. A study that appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association earlier this year surveyed the experts who participated in these panels. The study found that 87% had some financial ties to the pharmaceutical industry, and in nearly 60% of the cases, these financial relationships involved products which were under consideration in the guideline itself. While most leading medical journals currently disclose relationships that authors have with drug companies, this has rarely been occurring when it comes to clinical practice guidelines. Only one of these disclosed relevant financial relationships of its expert panel with commercial interests. Of the experts surveyed in the study, however, only 7% believed their recommendations were affected by these commercial relationships, but 20% felt that other individuals on the expert panel may have been influenced by these ties. The 7th National Sample Survey of Registered Nurses was released on February 22nd. The survey, which was carried out in the year 2000, revealed that the average age of nurses is rising significantly. In 1980, over half the nurses in the United States were under the age of 40. By the year 2000, only 31% of employed nurses were under 40. An especially large decline occurred among the under age 30 nursing population. This group represented a quarter of the nursing population in 1980, but by 2000, only 9% of nurses were under that age. While minority representation in nursing has nearly doubled since 1980, the 12% of nurses who derive from minority populations still fall well short of the 30% figure for the U.S. population as a whole. Adjusted for inflation, the earnings of nurses have been unchanged for the last 10 years. About 7 of 10 nurses surveyed reported being satisfied in their current position. This compares to the 90% average among professional workers as a whole. The dramatic aging of nurses in the United States has prompted the Department of Health and Human Services to increase funding for the Nursing Education Loan Repayment Program by 50%, up to 2,400 nurses per year. This program repays a substantial portion of the education loan of nurses who agree to work for 2 years in health facilities in areas which have shortages of nurses. But a far larger number of nurses are needed to remediate the shortage, and additional actions may be needed to address the relatively low levels of job satisfaction among nurses in the United States. The Bush administration has zeroed out the United Nations Population Fund from its 2003 budget and is withholding the $34 million appropriated by Congress for the 2002 fiscal year as well. This organization is the largest funder of women's health and contraceptive services for poor women around the world. The president is reportedly feeling pressure from some congressional representatives due to the fact that the Population Fund provides funding to China, where coercive policies have been pursued to stem the growth of its population, and due to the fact that in most poor countries, all women's health services are provided by a single agency, including abortion services. Though in every case the provision of abortions is a small fragment of women's health care, President Bush had promised to cut off funding to all international agencies at all involved with abortion, and he now appears to be keeping that promise. The British Medical Journal reports that tobacco advertising could become illegal in the United Kingdom as early as this summer, after the government agreed to back legislation pushed through the House of Lords last week. The proposed legislation will ban press, billboard, and internet advertising of tobacco products and end the promotion of smoking through free distribution of tobacco products and coupons for cigarettes. Also, new controls will restrict how tobacco products are promoted and displayed in shops, and sponsorship by tobacco companies of sporting and other events will be ended. Within the next 2 to 3 years, the Vaccine Advisory Committee of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will likely encourage the vaccination of infants and children under the age of 2 years. Recent studies demonstrate that such children are extremely susceptible to influenza virus and often have significant complications when infected. The Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices is urging flu vaccination of infants aged 6 months to 23 months starting at the beginning of the next flu season. Although the committee fell short of making a full recommendation, it is expected to do so within 3 years, pending the outcome of studies of the effect of more vaccines on parents and providers. Infants already receive about 20 injections. Currently, flu vaccination is recommended for elderly people aged 65 and over, healthcare workers, pregnant women, and people who are chronically ill with respiratory problems such as asthma, emphysema, and chronic obstructive lung disease, and those with renal failure, heart failure, and diabetes. Infants also represent an immunocompromised group as their immune systems are inexperienced. They have not been exposed to major harmful viruses and bacteria and are therefore susceptible to these diseases. One of the research reports studied infants from the state of Tennessee and found that infants aged under 1 year were as likely as elderly and high-risk groups to be admitted to the hospital for treatment of complications of influenza infection. Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On today's show, we will learn about cancer screening tests. Tests designed to detect a cancer in a patient who has no symptoms of the disease. We will be using prostate cancer screening as an example. Our guests today are Michael Wilkes and Gavin Yamey, who have received a grant from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to analyze and disseminate information concerning the usefulness of screening for prostate cancer. And that's what we'll be discussing today. Michael Wilkes received his medical training at the University of Connecticut and advanced training in preventive medicine and public health at Columbia University and then UCLA. He then continued on the faculty in the Department of Medicine at UCLA and more recently at the University of California at Davis, where he serves as a professor and a dean for medical education. Dr. Wilkes has been a frequent commentator on National Public Radio and ABC's primetime news show. Gavin Yamey received his medical training at University College Medical School in England and practiced internal medicine and served on the staff of the British Medical Journal thereafter. In the year 2000, he moved to California and became deputy editor of the Western Journal of Medicine. In that capacity, he works with Dr. Wilkes, who is the editor of that journal. Gavin Yamey and Michael Wilkes, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Now, I think to most people who are not in the medical profession, the rationale behind cancer screening is really pretty obvious. If I've got cancer, I want my doctor to figure it out as soon as possible, and I want him or her to get rid of it. So what are the obstacles to cancer screening?
Well, I think that the answer to the question is moderately complicated. The barriers to cancer screening, for good cancer screening, have traditionally been having limited access to screening tests, so that with things like cervical screening or breast cancer screening, you know, one of the major public health interventions have been trying to get people who are at moderate or high risk of having the disease to have access to the screening tests. In recent times, the technology has turned a bit, in that now there are technologies that are not nearly as well tested and well proven, and yet they're being very heavily promoted and advertised in a way that is driving people to get the tests without any clarity on if the tests can actually pick up the diseases that you're looking for.
Now, I know that one of the issues with cancer screening is the ability of the test to actually determine that there is a cancer there. In other words, if the test comes back negative, you really want to know that you actually don't have it. And I guess that's called sensitivity, right?
So there are two important measures of the accuracy of a screening test. One is called the sensitivity, and the other is called the specificity. The sensitivity is the chances that your test is positive when you do have the disease. So, for example, let's say you do have prostate cancer. The sensitivity is the chance that your PSA test, the test for cancer, will be positive. The specificity is the chance that the test will be negative when you are free of a disease. And both of these give you an idea of how accurate a test is. For example, we know that the specificity of the PSA test, the test for prostate cancer, is poor. Why? Well, in many cases, the PSA test comes up positive, but men don't have cancer. The test is wrong. What do they have? I mean, they do have an enlargement of their prostate, but this is a benign enlargement, a condition that doctors call benign prostatic hypertrophy. So in other words, the test comes up positive, but it's wrong.
Really what we're talking about is best illustrated by a recent trip to the airport. You go through the airport metal detector. The airport metal detector has a sensitivity knob on it. You can turn that knob up or you can turn it down. If you turn it up, every little piece of metal is going to set it off. So you're going to be picking up lots and lots and lots of people that have metal on them, but they're not guns or other weapons. On the other hand, if you turn it way down, you're not going to get any false positives. You're not going to get all the metal noise that you're getting when it's way up, but you risk missing some of the metal devices that might get through that could be used as weapons. So while that's more of a contemporary example, it's really what Gavin is talking about, is where do we want to set this so that we don't have too many false positives, because people that are identified as positive that don't end up having the disease are then going to have to go on and get some sort of an invasive test, often a biopsy, which involves cutting through the skin or putting a needle through the skin. On the other hand, if the test comes back and says you're negative, and you say, whoa, thank goodness I'm negative, but a week or a month or a year later you end up with cancer, well, you say, what happened with the test? Well, the problem was the knob was turned too low, and it was what we call a false negative result. So this is all sort of gamesmanship in trying to get a test that is set at the right level, that picks up cancer and doesn't have false positives and doesn't have false negatives.
Does how common a disease is in a population impact how useful a screening test for that disease might be?
It does. You know, first of all, in terms of resources, you know, we don't have enough financial resources in the world to screen for all kinds of diseases that affect one in a million or one in a billion people. So in that sense, it's important to look at how many people are affected. In a non-financial sense, we know that when something happens rarely, even a very, very accurate test is going to pick up lots of false positives. So, for example, in the state of Illinois that used to require HIV screening, if you screen all the people that are going to get married for HIV, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people in the period of a year, even though HIV test is a very accurate test, still the vast majority of people that come out positive and are told that it looks like they have HIV are in fact false positives. So you've scared them, you've worried them, their partner who they're about to get married to gets freaked out, only to be told a week later that, I'm sorry, the test was wrong, you really don't have AIDS. So that it does, it's very dependent on how common the disease is in the population that you're looking for it.
And it turns out to also matter whether there's actually an effective treatment. Do you want to bother screening for a disease for which the treatments maybe don't work very well? Is that a consideration too?
That's a major consideration. Ideally, you screen when you know that you can pick up the condition at a very early stage and when you can offer a treatment that will alter the course of the disease. There's no point screening for a disease if you really cannot do anything about it.
I'd like to talk a bit about the difficulties doing research on cancer screening. Maybe I'll start with an example. If I'm actively screening for a form of cancer that doesn't have an effective treatment at the stage my screening test is finding it, but another doctor isn't bothering to do that testing, then my patients will spend more of their lives knowing they have cancer, but they won't actually live longer. Comment on that type of bias.
Yes, that's one of the commonest kinds of biases that appear when you look at screening tests, and it's called lead time bias. When you have a cancer that is very slow growing, it's possible that a screening test picks it up at an earlier stage, but the actual disease outcome stays the same. But if you picked it up earlier, it appears as if your overall survival is longer. And that's a common kind of bias that we see in screening tests.
Are there any other types of bias that are commonly seen?
Yeah, the other common type of bias that is seen in screening tests is what doctors call length bias. We know that some cancers are very aggressive. In other words, when you develop them, they proceed very quickly and you may die of them very quickly. Other kinds of cancers are very slow growing. Now, if you have a screening test that is picking up the slow growing ones, it appears that that test is linked with a longer survival. The aggressive ones are not being picked up by the test at all. So if you're really just picking up the slow growing form and not the really advanced aggressive form, it really looks as if your test is very valuable, whereas in fact it might not be.
Now, I'd like to ask about another form of bias. Just the previous question before the last one, Dr. Wilkes pointed out that there could be a social type of bias on the part of the investigators. But I'm also interested to find out if there might be some degree of bias introduced into studies on the part of potential research subjects. Are people who have a greater belief in screening going to be randomly allow themselves to be randomly assigned in a research study?
Well, you have to remember that a lot of these studies are done before we know what the results of the test are. So, your question's a great one. If we were going to do a test today in cervical cancer screening, it would be hard-pressed to find women that were willing to be randomized to not being screened for cervical cancer. But when a test comes out, like rapid CT screening for coronary disease, and there's absolutely no data that it provides any benefit, then people are sure you can get a bunch of people that are willing to be randomized to help find out if this is an accurate test or not.
So for the major kinds of cancer that are quite common and which we're interested in screening for, how are the studies constructed that determine whether or not these forms of screening are useful?
The best kind of study for determining whether we should be going out and screening the population for a particular kind of cancer is called a randomized controlled trial. In other words, half the population would have the screening test and half would not have the screening test. And that's randomly assigned. That's the best kind of study for working out whether a screening test is worthwhile. I think it's incredibly important that we do these randomized controlled trials of cancer screening, because history has shown that a screening program that seems like a good idea could actually be harmful. The classic example was the screening program for lung cancer in America, where half the population were given chest x-rays to look for early signs of lung cancer, and the other half were not. And those who were given chest x-rays actually did worse. So it's incredibly important to do these trials so we can see whether screening is effective or not. There are other kinds of studies which haven't been done in this way, and where the results are a little bit more questionable, and which are more unreliable, and which you can't really trust in working out whether or not to screen the population. So, for example, for breast cancer screening, there have been at least 7 of these large randomized controlled trials. For prostate cancer screening, there have been no well-conducted large randomized controlled trials, so we don't have good evidence that screening is worthwhile for prostate cancer.
And now it may no longer be possible to do the test since people are so aware of them.
Yeah, this is a huge problem. There's 2 very large randomized controlled trials of prostate cancer screening. One's happening in America and one's happening in Europe. We won't get the results for some years. But we know that half of men are supposed to be screened and the other half are not supposed to be screened. But what we think is happening is that those men who are not supposed to be screened have heard about the PSA test. It's become common for men to have the test, particularly in America. And so these men who are supposed to not be screened are actually coming forward and asking for the test. So this is a big problem in these sorts of trials.
And when you do this type of study, you're interested in how long, comparing how long the populations, each of the 2 populations in the study live, regardless of what they die of. Is that correct, or you just count cancer deaths?
Well, we are interested in knowing about cancer deaths. We're also interested in knowing about patients' quality of life. So, for example, many cancer treatments are quite aggressive, and they can worsen a patient's quality of life by causing all sorts of symptoms. In the case of prostate cancer treatments, these treatments such as radiation therapy and surgery can make men impotent and incontinent, and if we don't look at these side effects, we won't get the whole picture of whether screening and treatment for a cancer is improving the quality of people's lives, not just the quantity.
So tell us how this is done. Clearly, you can easily measure deaths and hospitalizations, but how do you measure how much a woman treated for breast cancer dislikes her chemotherapy, or how much a man treated for prostate cancer dislikes urinary incontinence or impotence?
You can measure quality of life. There are all sorts of scientific tools for actually assessing how people are living their life and the quality of their life. And you can ask them and inquire about their sexual life, their sexual function in the case of prostate cancer, whether they're continent or incontinent. And then in deciding whether a particular screening test is valuable, what you need to do is to look at all of the data, not just on survival, but also on quality of life, to see whether the screening program would be worthwhile.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. My guests today are Gavin Yamey and Michael Wilkes, and we're discussing cancer screening. After the break, we'll discuss the controversy that occurred when our guests published an editorial in the San Francisco Chronicle recommending against screening for prostate cancer. And then later in the show, in our Viewpoint segment, we'll evaluate President Bush's energy plan, which Congress is expected to vote on soon, and we'll explore its likely impact on the public health.
This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guests today are Michael Wilkes and Gavin Yamey, co-editors of the Western Journal of Medicine. We've been discussing their review of the existing research on prostate cancer screening.
It strikes me that the media coverage of breast and prostate cancer screening have had very different histories. There have been a lot of public controversy about breast cancer screening, especially lately. While most doctors believe it should be done, especially for women between 50 and 70, on the other hand, patients have the impression that they may not like getting examined for prostate cancer with a rectal exam, but they believe they're supposed to be checked for that. And I don't think the public has actually been aware of the relative weakness of the research in prostate cancer. The two of you recently co-authored an article published in the San Francisco Chronicle on the state of the art on prostate cancer screening. What were your findings when you studied that issue?
When you look at all of the available scientific data on prostate cancer screening, you'd really have to conclude that there's no evidence that it benefits men's health, no really good scientific evidence, but there's plenty of evidence that it causes harm. And unfortunately, most men in America are not told this. Many men are encouraged to have an annual PSA test, the blood test for prostate cancer, from the age of 50, but they're not told how little scientific data there are to support having the test, nor are they told of the risks involved in having the test.
What are those risks?
Well, we've talked about the accuracy of screening tests for cancer, and we know that the screening tests for prostate cancer are not accurate tests. They have low sensitivity and specificity. Does this matter for a blood test like PSA? Well, it does, because if your blood test is positive, you'll go on to have a prostate biopsy. The biopsy is uncomfortable, painful, it can cause infection, bleeding from the rectum, bleeding into your urine, bleeding into your semen, and in a very small percent of cases, it can even cause very serious illness or even death. What's more, if your biopsy does end up showing prostate cancer, it's very likely that you'll go on to have treatment. Those treatments, such as radiation therapy or surgery, have very major side effects. Now, the problem is that many, many millions of men in America have prostate cancer, but the vast majority have an extremely slow-growing form that they'll never know about. They'll die with the prostate cancer and not of it. So the risk of screening is that you discover this completely harmless prostate cancer in a man, and then you subject him to treatments that leave him worried, impotent, and incontinent, and the disease would never have caused him any harm in the first place. We know that this happens far more often than that the test ever saves a life. And the other problem is that even if you do have an aggressive form of prostate cancer, there is no treatment that has been shown to be any better than the other. The various treatments that are available for prostate cancer are radiation therapy, prostate surgery, hormone tablets, or what doctors call watchful waiting, where you actually don't do anything but just wait and see. And actually, there's no evidence that any of those treatments are better than any other.
Well, this is actually somewhat alarming. How do you think it came to be that screening has become so common when you're saying that there's no research evidence to show it to be useful? Have studies been done?
I think that one of the problems that Americans have been in for a very long time is the idea that technology gets out in front of us and it doesn't get properly evaluated, and then some group that has a particular interest in the technology because it bolsters income or bolsters patient flow or what have you, endorse this, and all of a sudden it takes on a life of its own. I mean, if anything, the prostate story is a little bit heartening in that while it was extremely strongly endorsed when it was discovered In its initial days, lots of scholarly groups have backed off of endorsing it and have endorsed and have gone so far as to say they're not recommending it. So that, you know, it really, the story is one that is an important lesson for all of us, which is that, you know, A, this stuff has to get evaluated before it goes into public use. B, the most appropriate organization to do that evaluation is one composed and funded by the government so that there's no conflicts of interest. B, composed of scholars that have no vested interest in the particular area, so that a cervical screening test should not include a gynecologist per se, and a PSA shouldn't include urologists. There's no reason that you have to have the specialty involved in looking at this, and that all technology, whether it be screening or air imaging technology or blood tests, needs to be carefully evaluated before it reaches the public market.
So you published this article on indicating that prostate cancer screening was not useful or perhaps even harmful, and I understand that there was a great response to this article that you folks had published. Tell us about that.
Within hours of the piece appearing in the San Francisco Chronicle, we started to be bombarded by with emails from prostate cancer support groups, from urologists, from charities. And many of these emails were extremely angry. They were often very abusive. And they continued for several days after the piece appeared. Many people went even further, and they wrote to our employers demanding that we be silenced or that we be fired, and that we shouldn't have any educational responsibilities, we shouldn't be teaching medical students. And this has continued to this present day.
Were you surprised by the response?
I think given some of the conflicts of interest that we've talked about, we could always have expected there to be some backlash to our piece. I didn't expect that it would be this strong and certainly this abusive. We were compared to Nazis, our credentials were questioned, all sorts of accusations were made against us, and I certainly didn't expect that. I fully expected that people would challenge us on the merits of our argument, but I certainly didn't expect this kind of response.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't, I mean, Gavin's being kind. I mean, I was sort of blown away by this. I didn't expect to get but a letter or two, and even the San Francisco Chronicle, I think, was flabbergasted at how much mail they got about this issue. One has to be careful that one doesn't equate volume of mail in this day and age with, you know, reason. I mean, it's not a democratic vote as to whether the test is useful or not. It's a scientific debate, and the public are free to express their opinions. And as Gavin said, the decision about whether one person gets the test is obviously up to that person. It's not up to the doctor. It's up to the doctor to educate that person. But whether the test is actually effective and useful is something that, you know, 10 people who are experts should be able to look at the data and arrive at very very similar conclusions. And it's not a democratic vote or a wish. I mean, a lot of these men, I think, who wrote to us wanted to believe that this test was effective, and that when they got a negative test, it meant that they didn't have cancer, just as much as the town wanted to believe that the emperor was wearing clothes. And it wasn't until the little boy said, "Hey, Mom, he's naked," and everybody sort of was as flabbergasted as they were.
How much of the more abusive response came from doctors or organizations of doctors?
I don't think much of it. I think most of the response came from the public. Would you agree, Gavin?
Yes, most of the responses that were particularly abusive and angry were from the public. And it would appear that there was some kind of a coordinated campaign in this backlash. Many of these particularly angry and abusive letters were coordinated by prostate cancer charities. We know, for example, that one email was from a member of a prostate cancer listserv or email support group, and he wrote to others, presumably thousands or even hundreds of thousands of men across the country, urging them all to write to us and complain and write to our employers and demand that we be silent. So there is an element of coordination about it. And if you go and look at the information about these support groups on the web, we know that they encourage PSA testing. For example, the overarching prostate cancer support group that provides links among all the smaller groups is called the NPCC, the National Prostate Cancer Coalition. And their motto is, we're pro-PSA and proud of it. Do we think early detection of prostate cancer saves lives? You bet we do. So it's very clear that these organizations have made up their minds about PSA screening, right. Even though, as Mike Wilkes said, if you look at the data, there really are no good data to show that screening saves lives or improves the quality of men's lives.
Right. I think the other point to be made is that to many of these organizations, the decision may or may not have been arrived at to endorse PSA testing independently. I can't say the history of that decision, but I can say that a lot of these foundations, when Gavin says the word charity.
This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guests today are Michael Wilkes and Gavin Yamey, co-editors of the Western Journal of Medicine. We've been discussing their review of the existing research on prostate cancer screening. It strikes me that the media coverage of breast and prostate cancer screening have had very different histories. There have been a lot of public controversy about breast cancer screening, especially lately. While most doctors believe it should be done, especially for women between 50 and 70, on the other hand, patients have the impression that they may not like getting examined for prostate cancer with a rectal exam, but they believe they're supposed to be checked for that. And I don't think the public has actually been aware of the relative weakness of the research in prostate cancer. The two of you recently co-authored an article published in the San Francisco Chronicle on the state of the art on prostate cancer screening. What were your findings when you studied that issue?
When you look at all of the available scientific data on prostate cancer screening, you'd really have to conclude that there's no evidence that it benefits men's health, no really good scientific evidence, but there's plenty of evidence that it causes harm. And unfortunately, most men in America are not told this. Many men are encouraged to have an annual PSA test, the blood test for prostate cancer, from the age of 50, but they're not told how little scientific data there are to support having the test, nor are they told of the risks involved in having the test.
What are those risks?
Well, we've talked about the accuracy of screening tests for cancer, and we know that the screening tests for prostate cancer are not accurate tests. They have low sensitivity and specificity. Does this matter for a blood test like PSA? Well, it does, because if your blood test is positive, you'll go on to have a prostate biopsy. The biopsy is uncomfortable, painful, it can cause infection, bleeding from the rectum, bleeding into your urine, bleeding into your semen, and in a very small percent of cases, it can even cause very serious illness or even death. What's more, if your biopsy does end up showing prostate cancer, it's very likely that you'll go on to have treatment. Those treatments, such as radiation therapy or surgery, have very major side effects. Now, the problem is that many, many millions of men in America have prostate cancer, but the vast majority have an extremely slow-growing form that they'll never know about. They'll die with the prostate cancer and not of it. So the risks of screening is that you discover this completely harmless prostate cancer in a man, and then you subject him to treatments that leave him worried, impotent, and incontinent, and the disease would never have caused him any harm in the first place. We know that this happens far more often than that the test ever saves a life. And the other problem is that even if you do have an aggressive form of prostate cancer, there is no treatment that has been shown to be any better than the other. The various treatments that are available for prostate cancer are radiation therapy, prostate surgery, hormone tablets, or what doctors call watchful waiting, where you actually don't do anything but just wait and see. And actually, there's no evidence that any of those treatments are better than any other.
Well, this is actually somewhat alarming. How do you think it came to be that screening has become so common when you're saying that there's no research evidence to show it to be useful? Have studies been done?
I think that one of the problems that Americans have been in for a very long time is the idea that technology gets out in front of us and it doesn't get properly evaluated, and then some group that has a particular interest in the technology because it bolsters income or bolsters patient flow or what have you, endorse this, and all of a sudden it takes on a life of its own. I mean, if anything, the prostate story is a little bit heartening in that while it was extremely strongly endorsed when it was discovered and in its initial days, lots of scholarly groups have backed off of endorsing it and have endorsed and have gone so far as to say they're not recommending it. So that, you know, it really, the story is one that is an important lesson for all of us, which is that, you know, A, this stuff has to get evaluated before it goes into public use. B, the most appropriate organization to do that evaluation is one composed and funded by the government so that there's no conflicts of interest. B, composed of scholars that have no vested interest in the particular area, so that a cervical screening test should not include a gynecologist per se, and a PSA shouldn't include urologists. There's no reason that you have to have the specialty involved in looking at this, and that all technology, whether it be screening or imaging technology or blood tests, needs to be carefully evaluated before it reaches the public market.
So you published this article on indicating that prostate cancer screening was not useful or perhaps even harmful, and I understand that there was a great response to this article that you folks had published. Tell us about that.
Within hours of the piece appearing in the San Francisco Chronicle, we started to be bombarded with emails from prostate cancer support groups, from urologists, from charities.
Which Congress is finally expected to be voting on soon. We'll evaluate its likely impact on the public health and explore alternative proposals and look at their impact on our health as well. Stay tuned. Public Health Radio first looked at the relationship between energy policy and public health a year ago, when President Bush first proposed his energy plan. That plan has been enmeshed in controversy right from the start, both due to the substance of the plan and also due to the secretive manner in which the President's Energy Task Force operated. After extensive legal battles, it was recently disclosed that all of the consultation was with large energy companies, and the process excluded all other concerned groups. On today's show, I would like to revisit the issue. First, because Congress is expected to finally pass an energy program sometime during the next month or two. And second, because the events of September 11th last year should prompt a serious reconsideration of our country's energy policy. In the budget President Bush originally proposed to Congress, the President reduced the government's program to assist with the development of better conservation techniques and the development of wind, solar, and other non-polluting forms of energy generation. And this was not a small reduction. Their budget was cut by a whopping 40%. Instead, the Bush administration's energy policy proposal relies almost exclusively on increasing energy production from fossil fuels and nuclear power. As regards nuclear power, because there is no hope of ever safely storing waste that will remain poisonously radioactive for tens of thousands of years, the nuclear industry has not built a new power plant in over 20 years, and none are currently planned. factoring in the long-term cost of waste disposal, nuclear power is far more expensive than any other form of energy. We have been repeatedly told that nuclear is an economical form of energy, but since the industry has never been able to persuade any insurance company to offer a policy insuring against nuclear accidents, the taxpayers have foot the bill for insuring that industry right from the start. And a renewal of that legislation, the Price-Anderson Act, passed with little public notice a few months ago. So taxpayers will continue to provide free insurance coverage for the nuclear industry. On September 11th last year, the cost of nuclear power rose substantially. Nuclear facilities make a prime terrorist target, and taxpayers have already spent many millions of dollars attempting to safeguard these plants from terrorist attack. The major portion of the Bush proposal, however, is his policy on coal and oil. The administration program has two elements. The first is that more oil drilling and coal mining would take place within the United States. And the second part is to use these fuels to generate more electricity. Over the last 30 years, electricity consumption in the U.S. has grown 7 times faster than the population. So we are to burn more coal and oil in order to generate that electricity. After getting wind of the Bush energy proposal, environmentalists loudly and unanimously protested. How much more of West Virginia and Pennsylvania were going to be strip mined? How many oil spills would occur in the pristine Arctic Wildlife Preserve or along the spectacular coasts of Florida and California? This at a time when the average fuel efficiency of the vehicles we drive has dropped to a level not seen since 1979. Urban transportation planners pointed out that the 1990s was the first decade during which our transportation system began performing more poorly. Most roads in and around nearly every metropolitan area in the U.S. are more congested than they have ever been. Americans are wasting massive amounts of time idling their vehicles in stop-and-go traffic. That time would be much better spent with families or in almost any other way. Unfortunately, the public health community has not responded to the Bush energy plan with nearly the vigor that we should be seeing. The president's proposal will lead predictably to more deaths resulting from the exposure of our citizens to more atmospheric pollution. On an edition of Public Health Radio aired last summer, we heard Dr. Joel Schwartz, a nationally recognized expert on air pollution, summarize the mountain of research that has demonstrated the great harm to the public health brought on by fossil fuel combustion products. Combustion products and the burning of coal and oil are toxic to human beings. More hospitalizations and deaths are seen where levels of pollutants are higher. In Taiwan, where smoking among women is very uncommon, a study was undertaken to find out why lung cancer was relatively frequent among Taiwanese women. The researchers found that women residing in the vicinity of coal and oil-burning power plants were far more likely to die from lung cancer, and in fact, these plants accounted for half the cases. In December, the New England Journal of Medicine published the largest and most definitive study of air pollution yet undertaken in the U.S. 20 urban areas around the country were included, and the study reached similarly disturbing conclusions. Air pollution resulting from the burning of fossil fuels is a major contributor to death and disease, especially heart and blood vessel disease, and illnesses affecting the lungs. And this pollution does not lead merely to temporary disability, but to many deaths as well. The best estimate is that air pollution leads to approximately 100,000 excess deaths in the United States each year. But there is another important impact of energy use on public health. Year after year, transportation death rates in the U.S. dwarf those of any other country. And the number suffering life-altering, irreversible brain and spinal cord injuries is even greater. Tragically, these deaths and injuries disproportionately occur among people under age 45, dying in the prime of life. How do these vehicular deaths relate to our country's energy policy? A substantial chunk of our energy use goes to the operation of automobiles, trucks, and other vehicles, moving people from place to place in individual vehicles, each of which is contributing its share of pollution, uses far more energy than public transportation systems. Compared to the other developed countries, Americans use very little public transit. In their opposition to the development of public transit, the automobile companies correctly point out that distances in the U.S. are greater than in most other developed countries. And of course, public transit is not economical for rural areas. But it turns out that the vast majority of America's driving occurs in and around metropolitan areas, and right in parallel, the vast majority of deaths from transportation are in and around our cities. Houston, Dallas, Las Vegas, Denver, Los Angeles, and other cities with minimal, ineffective systems of public transit have vastly higher death rates than cities such as New York, Tokyo, London, and most every city in Europe. The death rates aren't even close. What's worse, the escalation in vehicle size and power has brought about a worsening in both fuel efficiency and safety. People now buy vans and SUVs believing them to be safe, but their high centers of gravity make them far more prone to rollovers. Their weight increases mortality in the vehicles they crash into, and their height increases the risk to pedestrians. In fact, compared to automobiles, owners of minivans are several times more likely to run over their own children while backing up. A year ago, when asked why he wasn't asking Americans to change their energy-intensive lifestyles, President Bush stated that he didn't ask for us to change because he felt that the American way of life was blessed. But one has to wonder how many of those who are living the blessed lifestyle President Bush refers to may not find it to be such a great blessing. Many might actually prefer a less energy-consuming lifestyle, but don't currently have the choice. Many Americans may not feel at all positive about the large number of miles they're currently driving, especially on roads that often slow to a crawl. They might prefer living in well-insulated solar-powered homes, which had far smaller electric and heating bills. They might like not having to finance, repair, and provide gasoline to keep a second and third household car on the road. Burning oil and coal was a great solution to problems we faced in the year 1870. But let's face it, it's not going to work for this century. When I think of energy use 30 years from now, I think of appliances that get the job done using 80% less electricity. I think of fuel cells. I think of super efficient solar systems, and I want my country, so full of talent and ingenuity, to lead the world in their development. America not only imports a great deal of oil, we are also currently importing solar collectors and wind turbines. What is more likely to get us to energy independence, drilling for oil or needing to burn a lot less oil? Which is going to get us where we need to go faster, the one vehicle per person model we've been using, or efficient public transit? Americans are very resilient and adaptable. In less than a generation, we have developed computers, and half our population has learned to use them. Earlier generations succeeded in settling a remarkable array of different environments in this country, and another generation succeeded in retooling to help win a war in Europe and the Pacific against the brutal face of fascism and Nazism. I ask of President Bush and Vice President Cheney, as the most influential political figures in this country, don't just tell us how wonderful and blessed we in our current lifestyle are. Instead, show some leadership. Give us some ideas that can move us forward to a better future. Since his energy proposal first surfaced a year ago, the Bush administration has been under a barrage of criticism, and several polls have shown that the public mistrusts President Bush and his policies on energy and the environment. In response, the president has altered his rhetoric greatly. But we have seen few substantive changes in policy. The big cut in support for sustainable energy has not been reversed. There is no public transit program, gas mileage of our vehicles will not be improving, and we are still set to go on a fossil fuel-fired power plant building spree. The events of September 11th have made the president's energy program more inappropriate than ever. Oil tankers make obvious targets for terrorism. So do oil pipelines, as do nuclear power plants. But are terrorists likely to go after wind turbines or solar collectors? I don't think so. September 11th has made the cost of President Bush's energy program much higher than it was when he first proposed it, since protecting against terrorist attacks on the energy facilities he envisions will fall largely on taxpayers. we can do better, a lot better. First, we ought to undertake a program of minimally polluting rapid transit for every major metro area which currently doesn't have one. And I'm not talking about the smelly, diesel-spewing buses that slowly amble about our urban areas. I mean clean systems that really move. Critics have stated that public transit is too expensive or that Americans don't like public transit, but in every city that has a system that provides adequate coverage and actually is rapid, these systems are quite popular. As far as the issue of cost, automobile travel could not be more heavily subsidized. Taxpayers finance everything from road building, plowing the roads, fixing potholes, placing traffic lights, installing traffic signs, paying for police to do traffic law enforcement, paying for the oil depletion allowance, paying for the cost of policing the Persian Gulf to protect the oil supply, to the cost of dealing with air pollution and treating the injuries to pedestrians and vehicular occupants who are injured in auto accidents. I don't think we've ever seen the cost of auto travel fairly compared to light rail transit. At this point, it will take at least 10 years for these systems to become more economically favorable as individuals make the decision not to replace their household's second or third cars. Second, we need to take the lead in the development of sustainable energy. During the 1940s, the U.S. government assembled a group of physicists and engineers. Their mission was to create a powerful weapon using nuclear fission, a form of energy which had never previously been harnessed. That effort was known as the Manhattan Project. Now, 60 years later, we need a new kind of Manhattan Project. In response to the energy crisis and the threat of terrorism, our government should once again assemble expert scientists and engineers. This time, however, the American scientists can be directed toward a peaceful energy goal: to set America on track to mastering the use of solar, wind, fuel cell, and other renewable forms of energy, and to produce the best, most economical conservation materials. This should be much easier than the Manhattan Project of the 1940s, since extreme secrecy will not be needed, and because we're dealing with forms of energy everyone's familiar with. We just haven't bothered to learn how to really take advantage of them. It's inexcusable that leadership in these areas has come from other countries. These should have been the proposals we heard, instead of irresponsible tax cuts and an energy proposal that dates from a previous century, and I don't mean the century that just ended. I ask everyone who is listening to this broadcast to contact your congressional leaders, asking them to support an energy plan consisting of these two components: a clean rapid transit program for every major urban area and a Manhattan Project scale effort to give America a leadership role in conservation and renewable energy. Tell them that we will benefit in six ways. Such a program is the surest way to give the U.S. a greater degree of energy independence, and that seems more important than ever since the events of September 11th and the current events in the Middle East. Second, it will help our economy by making our scientists and engineers world leaders in conservation and renewable energy technology. Third, the proposal is friendly to the environment. Fourth, the proposal improves our failing transportation system. Fifth, there would be fewer deaths resulting from atmospheric pollutants caused by fossil fuel combustion. And finally, we could decrease the number of tragic deaths occurring on the nation's highways. Well, that's it for today's show. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.